From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today, a focus on religion. Two churches in Macon, one black, one white, come together. Another congregation finds spirituality in a bar. And Robert Jones talks about how changing demographics might mean the end of white Christian America.
If you just go back to the 1990s, the number of religiously unaffiliated people in the country were less than 1 in 10. Today, that number is 23%. Nearly a quarter of the country claims no religious affiliation. And if you look at young people, it's more than a third.
That's coming up this hour. First, we talked last week about Georgia's GNETS program. It serves students with disabilities. The Department of Justice just sued the state over that program, alleging that students are segregated and mistreated. Marion Wang investigated it for ProPublica, and she says most kids don't need to be in GNETS.
They don't need to be in a segregated setting. If your neighborhood schools would just provide them more support, rather than sort of at the first, you know, instance or incident, they found that after a lot of the time, these recommendations that a child be placed in GNETS, that was occurring after one incident or a string of minor incidents.
Here are your first thoughts. Veronica McClendon tweets, the public would be amazed to learn of some of the types of students who are recommended for GNETS. GNETS is often a place where schools send students they don't want to be bothered with. And she adds, getting out of GNETS, almost impossible, tried to get a client out. The exit behavioral expectations were unrealistic for any child. But Helen Grace disagrees. She tweets this. This statement is completely untrue. One example, Glynn County had a 48% return to homeschool setting last year. We'd love to get what your thoughts are and your opinions. You can call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. If you walk out the front door of the First Baptist Church in Macon and turn the corner of the building and then peer through the trees there, you'll see the First Baptist Church of Christ. 170 years ago, there was only one congregation. Now there's a Black Baptist Church and a white one, but the pastors want to mend that rift. With me from Macon is the Reverend James Goolsbee of the First Baptist Church. Hello, sir.
Good morning.
And also with us is Reverend Scott Dickison of the First Baptist Church of Christ. It's good to have you as well.
Good morning, Celeste.
James, tell me about the initial rift back in just after the Civil War, I guess, 170 years ago. Why did the churches split apart?
There's a general belief that with the culture of the country at the time, with the fact that a majority of the membership of the combined church was African-American, but not in any leadership capacity, and then the majority of that number were slaves, that just the thought of whether direction the country was going, that it was better for the churches to worship separately. And that's kind of the gist of it. And separate church was built on property for the African Americans and grew separately from that. So it's something that happened with the way the culture was, with the way the sign of the times, with, again, with slavery and just the being in the South, it led to that separation.
Scott, what do you think of the history? I mean, we can imagine, but I wonder what kind of real evidence we have about what James is describing. Before the Civil War, this was a church where slave owners would come and they'd bring their slaves. So to a certain extent, it wasn't entirely unified.
No. And, I think one thing that's important to point out is that our church is really more representative of the church in America in that time. And really, the more we've looked into it, I think representative of the Church of America throughout our history. We've kind of followed the ebbs and flows, at least as far as race relations and divisions within the church. But the church was formed in 1826, and for the first 20 years was, you know, worshiped together whites and blacks, which was what was done back then. After a number of slave rebellions, African Americans were not allowed to congregate without white supervision. And so we see that in our church's history. After the initial split in 1845 for the next 20 years until the end of the Civil War, when the black members met, they would do so under the supervision of the white pastor, who was the kind of overseer of that congregation as well. So, you know, very complicated, but also, again, I think what we found to be so special about our history is that it's, you know, that it's not so special, that it really is representative of the church in that time.
So, James, for 170 years, these churches have been, I mean, they're within spitting distance also, I guess, if you're a really good spitter. Why is this the first time there's really been serious talk of, I guess, not merging the churches, but mending fences?
This is actually not the first time. There have been pulpit swaps in the 70s, attempts made to have certain relationships between the church, but I don't think there's been a concerted effort like it has been during this time. A lot of it has to do with Scott and I's participation in the New Baptist Covenant, mm-hmm. Which gave us a framework to work to try and develop relationships between the churches.
Scott, what is the New Baptist Covenant for those of us who are not Baptist?
Yeah, it was an organization that was formed, I believe, back in 2007. Jimmy Carter, President Carter, and other Baptist leaders sought to bring Baptists from different denominations, both white and black, together around the unification of the Baptist tradition, but also to do work towards racial reconciliation within the country. And over the last couple of years, that effort has really focused on bringing particular churches within a community together around serving the community in various ways, working for racial reconciliation through service.
If you're just joining us, my guests are two Macon pastors, Scott Dickison of First Baptist Church of Christ and James Goolsbee of First Baptist Church. You can join this conversation by tweeting us or going to Facebook. So, James, you're not talking about merging the congregations in terms of merging all into one under one roof, right?
That's correct.
So what does this effort mean, this concerted effort?
As we all know, it's been often said that the most segregated time of in the U.S. is on Sunday mornings. But what that does also is it prevents people from, especially Christians, to getting to know one another beyond the racial divide. We've experienced so much in terms of just getting to know our neighbors, getting to know our coworkers that we would work with on everyday basis, but not really understand them in terms of their faith. And as a result of just the interaction, the things that we've done together, the conversation that we're getting ready to have has already proven to be tremendously effective in just getting to know our brothers and sisters in Christ. And so that has been amazing, and we're excited about where we feel that's going.
Scott, what have been the obstacles? I mean, obviously, it's been 170 years. This is the first, I think you described it as a concerted effort. Why has it been difficult before?
Well, you know, probably for a lot of the same reasons that it's been difficult for our country. You know, I'd like to say as a pastor that the church has been a leader in racial reconciliation in our country's history, but you know, unfortunately, that's not really been the case. I think you've seen churches line up on both sides throughout you know, the last, you know, certainly 150 years since end of the Civil War, and I think our church has just been again representative of that whole trend of just following the dominant culture's lead in terms of, you know, how we view our neighbors, how we separate ourselves and live kind of parallel lives in a lot of ways. And that's really what our churches have done. You know, there hasn't been, you know, animosity or, you know, ill feelings. There just hasn't really been much relationship at all. And so that's, you know, that's really where we focused our energies is let's build a relationship. And from that relationship, hopefully build the trust that's necessary to really dig deeper into our histories and how we might use our church's history, our shared history, as a lens through which to view the racial history of the church and the country.
James, how different is a service in your church as opposed to a service in Scott's church?
He preaches longer than I do.
Oh, shots fired. Okay.
And that's really true. We were having an event. One of the first events we had was a joint Easter egg hunt. Mm-hmm. And that really wasn't planned. It just happened that we realized we were sharing the same park, both of the back entrances to our church, mm-hmm. literally back up to a park. And we were sharing that same park for years with Easter egg hunts with our youth, our children, and but on different days. And so we decided we'd share that park together and have a joint Easter egg hunt. Mm-hmm. And but to do that, we had to adjust our services. Even though we started at the same time, we ended at different times. So I said, okay, I'll preach short that Sunday. And Scott said, well, I'll preach a little longer. And so ultimately, that's the way we're able to get a compromised time to actually to share. So I would say that's one thing. But, I mean, worship is worship. And I don't think it's as much, excuse me, as the styles that it is, the fact that Scott gives a great message, and our messages are the same.
Scott, what will it look like if everything goes exactly as you hope that it will, and this is an ideal moving forward? What does that look like?
Well, you know, I think in the short term, you know, James mentioned the conversations we have planned for this fall, which will begin at the end of this month. We have Sunday evening conversations planned between our two churches, one in September and then October and in November. And, you know, where we're really hoping to bring our congregations together to talk about race in general. What are we talking about when we talk about race? Race as social construct and these sorts of things. And then moving on into our shared history to really look more critically at that and to hear how our churches tell that story differently. And there are, you know, significant ways, I think, that we have told that story differently.
I bet.
And finally, we really, and this is what we're building toward, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, we're hoping to have a covered dish supper together in our fellowship hall, where hopefully we will have built up trust and relationship to the point where people will feel comfortable sharing their own kind of personal testimonies around race. James and I are going to start to give our testimonies first, and then, you know, we haven't worked out the details on how exactly this will look, but we're really hoping that people will share. And after, you know, during each of these conversations, we're going to have space for people to discuss and kind of reflect together within the two churches. So for me, you know, I think if we can do what we hope to do over the course of this fall and move to a place where we have kind of taken on a shared language and how to even talk about race, to have a conversation about our histories where we hear each other and hear those differences and what we can learn from them, and then move to a place where we can, you know, share from our own personal experiences. If we can do that, I feel like we will have done something really special, and who knows where that will lead. You know, we're really focusing on the past, of course, so we can get more to talking more about the present and what we might do in the future. But if we can do that, I'll just be very, very pleased.
That is Scott Dickison of the First Baptist Church of Christ. We also spoke with Reverend James Goolsbee of the First Baptist Church. Scott and James, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, is Christianity actually on the decline in the U.S.? First, you know that joke about a rabbi, priest, and minister walking into a bar and the bartender says, "Is this some kind of joke?" Well, not for my next guest. We'll go to church in a bar. This is On Second Thought. Roughly 30% of Americans say they seldom or never attend religious services. That's up from last decade, according to the Pew Research Center. Staying excited and alert during church can be a challenge for people. Example, Homer Simpson.
Which brings us back to our starting point, the 9 tenets of constancy.
Damn it!
I seem to have lost my place. Well, I'll start over.
Aw, for the love of crumb cake.
But one church on Tybee Island is reaching out to the Homer Simpsons of the world, those who don't feel a connection to a traditional church.
Nowhere else I'd rather be dancing with you.
It's not unusual to hear rock music inside Benny's Bar on Tybee Island, but only on Sunday is that music about God. Last year, I spoke with the pastor of Bar Church, Michael Elliott. He was joined by worshiper David Cahill, who helped start the church about 6 years ago. I began the conversation by asking Michael about his decision to bring the gospel to a bar.
Well, Jesus didn't start in a church. I mean, he started in people's homes and in public places and worship, and I'm sure he went to at least one bar. At least he turned water into wine at a wedding. And so, you know, way before stained glass, there was good worship. And so we have gone back to reclaiming church without stained glass.
And do you allow drinking in the church other than communion wine, I guess?
We have very good communion wine. Let me start with that when we do. It's very good. But, you know, no, in the state of Georgia, I mean, we have church at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings. State of Georgia, you can't serve alcohol until after 12:30. Although I'm sure if those laws changed, people might try to have more communion.
David, what's the thought? Why was this church needed?
It was needed because a lot of people, they felt really uncomfortable being in a traditional church and hearing their somebody's interpretation of the Bible as to how they need to live their life. And then when Sam presented this idea to me, at first I was a little skeptic because I'm thinking to myself, you're wanting to do what and do it where? And he was one of my really good friends, and I jumped in with both feet, and I haven't looked back. I enjoy every bit of it.
I wanted to play you a clip from this actually went on YouTube. This is a spoken word poem from a man named Jefferson Bethke. It's called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus, and it's gotten more than 30 million views on YouTube. Take a listen.
See, the problem with religion is it never gets to the core. It's just behavior modification like a long list of chores. Like, let's dress up the outside, make it look nice and neat. But it's funny, that's what they used to do to mummies while the corpse rots underneath. Now I ain't judging, I'm just saying, quit putting on a fake look. Because there's a problem if people only know that you're a Christian by your Facebook. I mean, in every other aspect of life, you know that logic's unworthy. It's like saying you play for the Lakers just because you bought a jersey.
So, Michael, I wanted to put this to you. It's gotten so many views, I think, because it's resonated especially with younger people. But if you just move the church service inside a bar, how does that address what he's really talking about there?
Well, I think it's two things. I think he's acknowledging the fact that organized and institutionalized religion, as exists especially in the United States over the past couple of centuries, has become a place of dogma and not acceptance. A place of rules and not relationship. A place where you go to celebrate your guilt rather than a place where you go to feel guilt-free. And at Bar Church, I can tell you, when we gather together, I mean, it's a crazy little unplanned, non-institutional, wickedly wild worship experience. I mean, people show up, they bring food, we convert pool tables into potluck banquet tables. People show up to eat. A bar band turns into playing a plethora of music that ranges from hymns to contemporary songs that have spiritual meanings. And then there's a lot of sharing, a lot of acceptance, a lot of all the things that you don't find behind those buildings with stained glasses and steeples. And so, you know, I think we embody, you capture what he is saying very well in this non-scripted experience.
Well, let me actually, let's take a listen to that church band. Here they are performing at the Oceanside Nursing Home. David, were you going to church regularly before you started attending the church in the, you call it Bar Church, is that correct?
Tybee Bar Church, that's exactly right. No, I was not attending a traditional church. When I was young, I was raised Catholic, and it was a force of habit for me to go to church. It was something that, I mean, I did out of habit. And I went there, you know, I'd balance my checkbook, I'd make out my grocery list, see what bills I had to pay, and never really gave the message much thought. And after, you know, my marriage here and I moved out to Tybee, church was the farthest thing from my mind. The only time I really went to church was on Christmas and on Easter. And when Sam and I, we got to be real close.
You mentioned Sam before. Sam Adams, you and he helped found the church.
Correct. And when he presented this idea to me, at first I was thinking it was going to be typical Tybee. Something's new. After 6 months, the news going to wear off. People will quit. And it's done nothing but grow and grow and grow and grow. And I don't know how many followers we have on Facebook, but it's getting to be quite a few. And we're getting a lot of new faces in church that are from out of town that they're absolutely just loving this.
So do you go now every weekend?
Oh, yeah. I'm there every Sunday. I'm there.
Okay, so let me make sure. I'm going to fact check you here and make sure you are paying attention. What was the message this past Sunday?
You'd have to ask Michael on that one. I do go there. I've got a wife that she's not doing too good. And I get a text during church. And she said, if there's fruit, can you please bring me a plate of fruit right now? So as Michael was speaking, I load her up for her plate of fruit, take it to her.
Well, there you go.
See how popular I am when it comes to the sermon stuff?
Michael, what was your message this past weekend?
It was on the parable of the talents, and it was about how Jesus left us with ideas because he didn't have any money and he didn't have any other things, but he left us ideas of love and acceptance. And, you know, we either take that message and we multiply it and we gain more love and acceptance, or we just sit on it and nothing happens, and that's where you find hell.
So is this, I understand this is a non-denominational church, but is it basically a Christian church?
Yes, although we are very open to multiple ways of expressing your love of God. Our orientation is predominantly Christian, yes, but we've had some great spiritual and, you know, even non-Christian expressions of their love for God. I mean, we're an accepting bunch, and, you know, you come as you are and you bring who you are, and whatever that is, you know, we'll figure out some way to work it in.
So what are you missing by preaching in this particular church? You don't have a daycare or Sunday school, right? You wouldn't want to, I mean, do people bring children into the bar?
Yeah, children do come. We don't have Sunday school. And, you know, we don't have evening services, although people gather in their own as kind of an outgrowth for Bible studies or for support groups or for those kinds of things. We also do the nursing home ministry. We also have special services for the holidays for people who have nowhere to go. And so, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving and, you know, we open up and there's a big party, basically. And so we give a place, a home for people who don't have a home, regardless if they're living in a house.
All right. So, David, I want to play you another comment. This is actually the president of Barna, which is a nonpartisan research group. The president spoke to NPR.
Each person that we interviewed had very specific experiences and challenges, and the church was in some way inadequate in their mind to that. And yet, when we looked at it from a broad perspective, the way I would conclude this is that we're living in a more complicated age, more complicated questions about marriage and the diversity of this generation, the technology use in social media. And in a nutshell, what we learned is that churches aren't really giving them an answer to this complicated questions that they're facing, these lifestyle issues and challenges that they're facing. And it's not really a deep or thoughtful or challenging response that most churches are providing to them.
So I wonder, David, if you think your the Tybee Island Bar Church does answer those kind of complicated questions. What makes it different? Other than the location, what makes it different?
I don't know if it's really different or not, but we're very, very accepting. We don't tell anybody how they need to live their life. And it's like, you know, some of the typical churches, they pass the hat around like, you know, you will give this. You know, we have never asked that because a lot of the members, they're on fixed income. They can't afford to give anything. And the ones that do, you know, we have a donation bucket. You know, if they want to feel like they need to give something, they can. If not, that's fine. We ask nothing of nobody. We're not a money-driven church. We never have been. And as far as the technological side of it, I'm 52. I started my Facebook page less than a week ago.
So, Michael, listen, a lot of us grew up in an era when you showed respect for God by dressing up nicely for church, right? I went to church with women who all wore very, very fancy hats and sometimes gloves. The glory of the building was supposed to reflect the glory of God, right?
Right.
So what is that like for you as a pastor? As I understand it, people show up to your sermon and your service on Sunday wearing flip-flops and shorts.
That's correct. And I wear shorts and a bar church t-shirt and flip-flops too. And so, you know, it's come as you are. Honestly, some people do dress up to come, but the norm is, you know, folks come just very comfortable. And as Davey said, you know, there's no judgment about anything, and, you know, don't come with a sense of having to prove anything. Just come to a place where you can be accepted. And, you know, it's no different from the old theologies. You know, God's bigger than a box, and religion tries to stuff God in a box. And that's, we don't try to do that at the bar church. We just try to enter into our relationship with God.
Was there resistance from the other churches in the area?
Confusion would be a better word. There was a lot of confusion from the other churches who are very mainstream. And they have wrestled in how to establish a relationship with us because we're just so different from them.
What's, David, what's the congregation look like? Who's your average bar church goer?
Long hair, flip-flops, unshaven face.
A lot of folks that come are people who have been wounded by traditional church. And so those folks have a tendency to dress kind of like traditional church. But we also have folks that clean the hotel rooms on the island, that work in the restaurants, that are bartenders, who feel shunned and unaccepted by traditional church. And they have found a home in bar church.
I got to say, if you're going to say long hair, flip-flops, and a beard, that kind of sounds like Jesus. I mean, you're kind of describing Jesus Christ, aren't you? Long hair, flip-flops, and a beard. But in any case, let me take it back to the kind of service that you have. Michael, can you kind of describe, walk me through a typical 10 a.m. Tybee Island Bar Church service?
We start at 10 o'clock Island Standard Time, which means somewhere between 10 and 10:15. Service starts with a band, and we have a lot of great musicians and friends from around the region who come in and out. So every week there's a different kind of set of players. And, you know, that's a set of music, and the music ranges from anywhere to Blessed Assurance, Jesus Is Mine, to Tin Man by America, or to Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi. And then we will stop and have prayer time. This past Sunday, one of our congregants came up and held a prayer circle in front of the stage that went on for about 10 minutes. And then the band went into another set of five or six very eclectic songs. After that, we have a sermon, and I use that in a very loose definition. There's a lot of storytelling that goes on in our service. Then other congregants come up, and we always end with the Lord's Prayer. And then there's always, which the entire congregation does together, the band normally launches into a few other songs. There's always special requests throughout the service that alters the service during the middle of it. So if we tried to follow a bulletin, we would spontaneously combust, because there's a lot of give and take of the moment. And so no service is the same.
How long is a typical service?
An hour. Although people show up early to eat. So it's hard to say when church actually begins and when it actually ends, because lots of people stay long afterwards too. But, you know, the formal, informal part of it, you know, is about an hour.
And how many people do you have on average?
We're in our second bar now. We're in the biggest bar we've been in, and we fill it every Sunday. Some Sundays they're on the sidewalk and can't get in. You know, Jesus called us to feed his sheep, not to count them, and so we don't count, quite honestly. But, you know, we fill the place up, and sometimes we overfill it, and they're on the sidewalks listening through open doors.
That was a portion of my conversation with Michael Elliott. He's pastor of Bar Church on Tybee Island. I also spoke with David Cahill, who helped found that church. Sunday services start at 10 a.m. inside Benny's Bar on Tybee. We'd love to hear from you. Would you go to church in a bar? Does it matter where church services are held? You can tweet us. Our handle is at OST Talk or post on our Facebook page. A significant demographic change has happened since Barack Obama first ran for president in 2008. White Christians went from making up 54% of the country to less than half. Author Robert Jones argues this decline is important if you want to understand today's political landscape, from the success of Donald Trump to the heated rhetoric over the nation's top social issues. Jones is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's also author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. Adam Ragusa spoke with Robert Jones in July.
So first of all, is there a qualitative judgment implied in your work? Are you lamenting the decline of white Christian America? Are you celebrating it, or are you merely describing it?
Yeah. Well, you know, PRI, of which I'm the CEO, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. And really in the book, I try to be fairly circumspect about this really massive event in the country's life. And, you know, I begin the book with an obituary that where I kind of personify white Christian America and talk about its death, a little bit tongue in cheek, but I think laying out some important realities. But I end the book with a eulogy where I kind of imagine myself presiding over this very complicated death. And if you think about, you know, a kind of complicated death in the family where you have some people who are very close to the deceased and really grieving this loss, but then you have maybe other people who had more complicated relationships, maybe even conflictual relationships, who are, you know, more than happy to say good riddance, and then some other people in between. And I think that's the tone of the book, is really trying to describe this really new reality that the country has entered into, and the very different reactions that different factions in the country are having to it.
People talk a lot about the decline of white America, or rather, the more often, the rise of non-white America. People talk about the decline of religiosity in America. Why look at white Christians together? You could look at white people. You could look at Christians. Why white Christians?
Yeah. Well, that's a really insightful question. I mean, I think that is the key to really understanding this cultural shift. I mean, you know, from, you know, the beginning of the country, I think it's important to remember the power, not just that white Christianity had, but white Protestant Christianity had, you know, in the country. You know, we look back at, if you look at the early, you know, constitutional Congress and members of Congress early in the country, all the way through really the middle of the 20th century, it was really white Protestants
right.
That had power in the country. There's this great line in one of the books as I was doing research by historians said, put it this way, if you were in charge of something big and important all the way up through the middle of the 20th century, chances are you were white, male, and Protestant.
Right. It's been only recently that we've even really lumped Protestants and Catholics together. It's only been recently that I feel like Catholics have been accepted into the concept of whiteness as it really functions in America.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you don't have to go back that far to look at census forms, and you see things like if you were an Irish Catholic, you know, you were classified as a Celt. For example, on census forms, not Caucasian, and that's not that far back there in our country's history. The, you know, extreme amount of questioning that President Kennedy had to face in 1960, even as we're headed to the second half of the 20th century, about whether he would answer to the Vatican, you know, as if he were elected president, and those were like questions poised by, you know, Protestant ministers with deep, deep concerns about this, you know, pretty late. That's just a few decades ago.
In your book, you talk about three waves of white Protestant resurgence over American history. Do you want to give us the dime tour of all three?
Sure. Yeah. You know, one way I do this is through actually a little tour of buildings at the beginning of the book. And I sort of use them again as kind of stand-ins or metaphors for the larger thing. So, you know, one interesting building I'm here in Washington, D.C. is a United Methodist building that is the only religious building on Capitol Hill. It's a triangular building. And if you look out one window, you see the U.S. Capitol. You look out the other window and you see the U.S. Supreme Court building. And it is literally, you know, a stone's throw away from both of those buildings. And when it was the money was being raised for that building, it was built by one single mainline Protestant denomination, the Methodist, and it was built to be a sentinel on Capitol Hill, right, to keep a watchful eye. It was the largest denomination in the country at the time, to keep a watchful eye on Congress. That's the kind of first wave, I think, is like just a single denomination really exerting that kind of power and believing that it could exert that kind of power over national politics. And then the second wave was more of an ecumenical movement, mostly around the more liberal end of the mainline Protestant world, so Episcopalians and Presbyterians and the Methodists, realizing that they needed to kind of band together and building this big building called the Intercultural Center in New York City, sometimes called the God Box in New York City. Big limestone-clad structure, land, and a lot of money donated by John D. Rockefeller Jr. to build this edifice. And it really was about also, and to kind of tie to the other comments, built to push back on what it saw as twin threats to the Republic, and that was communism and secularism on the one hand, but the other one was Catholicism, and built to kind of exert kind of Protestant dominance. And then the third wave really hits in the 1980s and 90s as the mainline Protestant denominations begin to wane in the 70s and 80s. We see this rising crest of the white evangelical Protestant world, the more conservative end. And the building I kind of isolate there is this. Amazing building built outside of L.A., the Crystal Cathedral, built by the ministry of Robert Schuller, that in its heyday, you know, was on TV all the time. And this building was built with 10,000 panes of glass and was called by the New York Times at its opening, perhaps the most important religious building since the Cathedral of Notre Dame was erected in Paris. What's interesting about it is that, you know, by the first decade of the 21st century, that ministry had gone bankrupt. They ended up having to sell the building. And who buys the building? But the Catholic Church buys the building. And it is now a multi-ethnic, multilingual Catholic cathedral in that same space.
We're talking to Robert Jones. He's the author of the new book, The End of White Christian America, catching us up now to the present day. Robert, is the decline of white Christian America the result of something that's happening within the white Christian demographic, or is it merely that demographic is being outnumbered by the influx and rise of other kinds of people?
It's facing both internal and external factors. So externally, certainly the things that the Census Bureau has been talking about, that, you know, the year 2042 now is the year that the country will be a majority non-white country, sometimes called a majority, you know, majority minority with quotes country. But that's still out on the horizon a little bit. The other important thing that I think has just not been put together with these demographic shifts are the large number of white Christians who have left Christian churches over the last few decades. So if you just go back to the 1990s, the number of religiously unaffiliated people in the country were less than 1 in 10. Today, that number is 23%. Nearly a quarter of the country claims no religious affiliation. And if you look at young people, it's more than a third.
And is secularism rising faster in white America than in non-white America?
Yes. I mean, so, you know, it's important to say that this kind of rise in the unaffiliated has been almost entirely due to, you know, a kind of coined term, white flight from Christian churches, you know, that we see that African-American Protestants have basically held their own over the last few decades. And actually, if you look at Latino Christians, that number has actually been growing over time. So it really is this story of kind of white Christians leaving churches and becoming nothing, really, claiming no religious affiliation.
We asked people in Midtown Atlanta about what the decline of white Christians will mean for the country. Here's what a fellow named Kevin Campbell had to say.
The morality will change. Things that were once taboo will not be anymore. For instance, the political correctness. Everybody's upset because they can't, you know, say what they mean without offending anyone anymore, but it's like, those things were always offensive. They just nobody spoke up about it before. And now that there's less white Christians, I guess, then people feel more empowered to speak their minds.
Now, he mentions their political correctness, which is something that the Trump campaign brings up over and over and over and over again. Robert, do you think that that is part of the appeal for white Christian voters who are supporting Trump? And what does it mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, I should say that it's important to note that nowhere in my book do I mention Trump. The book was actually wrapped about the time that Trump announced his candidacy, when no one was really taking it all that seriously.
You had foresight.
Yeah. So but I do think it casts some really interesting light on what's going on here. So, you know, one part of kind of the attack of political correctness is always has a nostalgic ring to it, right? That it used to be that we could just say what we think, but now we can't.
Yes.
Because there's this changing America. We're going to offend someone, as this this person said. But to kind of identify and isolate this sense of nostalgia, I think is really important, because I think that this is a very powerful emotion arising from this sense of vulnerability and change, and this realization that, you know, if to kind of again take this metaphor of white Christian America, that kind of cultural and political edifice that was built by white Protestant Christians, that for most of the nation's history really did set the tone for our conversation, shaped our ideals. But I do think this sense of nostalgia is a dangerous one, really, for the country, and it's pretty powerful in this group. So just to give you one number here, when we asked a survey of Americans whether you think that American culture and way of life has gotten changed for the better or changed for the worse since the 1950s. The country as a whole is evenly divided on this question. But when we look at white evangelical Protestants, we find that like 7 in 10 say it has changed for the worse. And so this is the group that really forms a core of, surprising core, really, of Donald Trump's support. And I think what's happened there is that Trump has really succeeded in converting these kind of self-described values voters in past elections into nostalgia voters in this election.
Let's talk about the South, where you could say that maybe the group that we're talking about today, white Christians, still retains considerable power. Maybe not so much. Certainly here in Atlanta, white Christians have to share a lot of the power with people who aren't white. How do you see this trend manifesting in the Southern United States?
Yeah. Well, I'm from Mississippi. I did my graduate work at Emory University, and actually my 1996 moment was actually moving to Atlanta to start my graduate program there. But you know what? Here's what I think is different in the white South today. That you know, even if you go back to the Jim Crow era, certainly before that, you had this sort of assumption, I think, among many Southern white Christians that that really their values were still in many ways central to the country's identity, right? So even if they knew that there were African Americans who they were often in tension with, there was still this sense that they really still had a hold on power in the country. And what's different today, I think, and why we see this very defensive posture among many white, especially white conservative Christians, is that they have this real sense, you know, it's also, remember, if we look at the same period, only 4 in 10 Americans supported gay marriage, for example, in 2008, just two election cycles ago. Today, that number is 53%. So if you look at just that bellwether issue, it's such a visible indicator that for those conservative white Christians who are kind of all in opposing this issue, that the country has really moved on to a different place. And so I think the thing is really different. It's even if you live in an enclave, in kind of a white Christian enclave in Cobb County, it's not so easy to think that the rest of the country still resonates with your values. You increasingly sort of understand yourself as a minority. And I think it's that sense of vulnerability that kind of fuels this strong kind of visceral reactions that we see sometimes to our politics, and this strong sense of nostalgia.
Right. Majority and dominance are related but distinct concepts. You can have a minority that is nonetheless dominant. But we're heading to a point here where white Christians may be losing both dominance and their majority status. We're talking to...
That's well put.
Robert, thank you. I stole it from your book. Robert Jones is the author of The End of White Christian America. Robert, you write that the death of white Christian America could actually revitalize American politics. How might that happen?
Well, I do think there's been this sense of a kind of, you know, captured captivity by partisan politics. And what we see in the political science literature is that the power of partisanship has really taken off in the last few decades, or the same kind of period I'm looking at these changes, and that one of the things that's happening is that religious groups have been sort of divided and ripped apart, really, by their kind of partisan allegiances, and there's been this kind of resorting. And I think when you have a kind of powerful demographic, there's a real temptation to do that. And I think one of the openings that may happen here, as you know, particularly kind of white evangelicals who have tended to vote 7 and 8 or 8 and 10 for Republican candidates, they still look like that's going to happen this year, interestingly enough. But one opportunity here, as a group sort of moves from being a kind of dominant cultural group that is sort of exerting all this political power to a more minority group, is that there may be an opportunity to rethink that relationship to power. And I think that could be a real opportunity. Because when we ask young people today why they've left churches, one of the things we hear is too much involvement in partisan politics. And so I think the chance for churches to rethink that might be a way to be able to reach back out to some of these young people that have left.
More specifically, how do you see the decline of white Christian America affecting the Republican Party in particular?
Yeah. Well, the real challenge, I think, and I'm not the first one to sort of point this out. In fact, the Republican National Committee was the first one to point this out right after the 2012 election, Romney's loss, that this, what I call in the book, the white Christian strategy of trying to pile up supermajorities of white Christian voters to offset these other growing segments of society among Latino voters, non-religious voters, is really, it's in the long term a losing strategy. I mean, I argue in the book that Romney's campaign was the last one that this was going to be even a plausible strategy. But surprisingly enough, I think with the selection of Pence as VP choice, that Trump has actually kind of doubled down on this white Christian strategy. So we may have a real test case ahead of us about whether this is viable or not. I have my real doubts, because it is a diminishing pool of voters that the Republican Party in particular continues to be relying on. Real quickly, just Mitt Romney was 8 in 10 of Mitt Romney's coalition were made up of white Christian voters, compared to only 37% of Barack Obama's coalition in the 2012 elections. That's just not a viable strategy for the future.
That was a portion of the conversation between Adam Ragusea and Robert Jones. Jones is the CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the new book, The End of White Christian America. It's available now.